So I was saying the last Upanishad we saw, Isavasya Upanishad, starts with the word Isavasyam Idam Sarvam. So in that Upanishad, the emphasis was to show that this tattva called Ishvara is enveloping everything, or it's through and through every creation that we see here. So the entire world of plurality is achadaniya, is enveloped by this tattva called Ishvara. That was the emphasis. So wherever we see, we must therefore see nothing other than the expression of that Supreme Brahman. That was the central theme, that was the idea. And then it was mentioned that in order to attain that Brahmanhood status in this life, you can choose either of the two paths. Either you can do the karma marga, meaning path of action, path of indulgence in the society. You can remain a householder, etc., etc. Or you can choose the path of sannyas. So you can choose the path of detachment. So those were the two. And it was mentioned that either way, you can reach that supreme goal practicing what was prescribed in the Upanishad as well as in the Dharma Shastra. And then in the end portion, it was mentioned that it is better to combine the technique of Upasana along with the technique of Karma Yoga. So when Karma endowed with Upasana or Upasana endowed with Karma is performed, then the result will be much, much superior. The progress in spirituality will be much faster. That was what was mostly taught in the Isavasya Upanishad. Now in this Upanishad, Kena Upanishad, the emphasis is on direct knowledge. So that which cannot be defined, that which cannot be uttered, that which cannot be thought about, that which cannot be conceptualized, where the eyes don't go, the ears don't go, the mind doesn't go, the speech doesn't go, etc., etc. The attempt is to convey what that is to the student. So in that sense, this is a very direct Upanishad. Direct knowledge is given without defining. In fact, even the word Brahman is not used until the third mantra in this Upanishad. That is indicated only as that ear of the ear, the speech of the speech, the mind of the mind, etc., etc. So no conceptualization, no chance of conceptualization is given in the initial portion of this Upanishad. And then it was mentioned that one who is Dhira Purusha, one who has attained this equanimity and sharpness of the mind and intellect, they will be able to reach that state of Brahmanhood. They will be able to identify what that Brahman is. In this very life, becoming Jivan Mukta, and then at the end of this life, when the body falls off, they will attain Videha Mukti. That means they will become Amrutatva Bhavanti. They will become immortal. They will not have to come back again and again in this cycle of life and death. And then in the second chapter, because that subtle idea may not have been very clear to the student, therefore the teacher comes down just a little bit lower and said, please understand that you are experiencing that Brahman at every breath of your life. In every experience, what you are experiencing is nothing other than Brahman and Brahman alone. Because it is Brahman because of which all the indriyas, all the senses are working. It is Brahman because of which the mind is working. Therefore, through and through the mind, through and through the eyes, through and through the speech, through and through the ears, what you are experiencing is nothing but the functioning of that Supreme Consciousness alone. And then it was pointed out that this Supreme Consciousness is the witness or is the ultimate subject called Pramata, and that subject only takes up this upadhi or this superimposition of being a subject as long as the object is there, But when it so happens that there is no objectifiable entity means thoughts also, by the way. Thoughts are nothing but objectifying. Objectifying anything is a thought. So when there is no objectifiable entity in front of the subject loses its identity as a subject and merges into what it inherently is, which is nothing other than Supreme Consciousness. So far that much knowledge is given, and the second chapter is also over. Now two more chapters are there. So what is there more to say? Really speaking, the Upanishad is over with this chapter. No more needs to be said. However, out of the compassion, when the Guru looks around, there are a lot of students still sitting there. So therefore, he thinks that maybe the highest knowledge that I tried to convey, without defining that Brahman Tattva to the best of my ability, because the students are not prepared, the Adhikaritvam is not as ripe as possible, or maybe the teacher is thinking that I have failed miserably in my attempt. Therefore, let me re-message the entire Upanishad in a story form. So therefore, in the third chapter of this Upanishad, an elaborate story is given in 11 mantras. So first we will look at the story. First we will look at why the story is needed. Then we will look at the story. And then we will dive a little bit into the significance of the story, etc., etc. Now, why is the story needed is an important thing. I already mentioned that if the student is not well prepared, then in order to make some sense to the student, a story is given. This is also a Puranic style, by the way. It so happens that Veda Vyasa has used this technique to the best of his ability to create so many Puranas. It is said that he is an author of 18 different Puranas. And so in all those Puranas, there is always a story. A story within a story, and then a story within a story. And each story is signifying one aspect or the other of spiritual path. So we will see that in this story also, the story is so nicely woven that it actually represents the entire highest philosophy that actually the teacher has already given. It does not contradict it. It only establishes it again. So we can say that in the first and second chapter, no error is introduced. No error in giving the highest knowledge is introduced by the teacher. He has been very, very careful about it. But when a story has to be given, that which is a non-manifest entity has to be shown as a manifested entity, number one. Second, that entity which is pervasive everywhere and yet cannot be seen, and that should not be a surprise, because that which is most pervasive is the most difficult to see, isn't it? And we know air is there because we are breathing it, but we cannot see the air unless you happen to be in Delhi. And you can see the air of the pollution. But we can feel the air. So at least we know, okay, there is air. Then subtler than that, you can go to space. The only reason why we are aware of space is because there is a depth perception. So I perceive there is a gap between where you are sitting and I am sitting here. So there is this perception, we call it a space. But you cannot directly see the space. Supposing if you can imagine where you are actually sitting on top of a pointed needle, and there is nothing surrounding you, will there be a perception of space? Imagine that you cannot put your hand out like that. Then there is space perception over there. But let's suppose there is nothing. Isn't it? So therefore, it should not surprise us that that which is all-pervasive is the most difficult to see with any senses. So therefore, that which is most pervasive is actually crystallized into an entity in this story. So the second point. And that entity doesn't say anything, do anything, it just appears hovering there as if it's a UFO, suspended in air with an effulgence and appears out of nowhere. These are all very important points because these are all representative of the Brahman. And when the devatas approaches, then this entity speaks up and says, "Who are you?" So therefore, now there is again one step, it's a superimposition of the entity, which is an entity which is impeccable at all times, does not change itself, cannot modify itself, etc., etc., is now able to speak. We don't even know whether it spoke or whether that question, "Who are you?" came into the mind of the devatas somehow. Right? So then the story will go, we'll look into the story. But this is the one point. The second point is, so first reason is, okay, the story is given because Mandabuddhi. So why Mandabuddhi? Mandabuddhi means people who are little dull-witted is called Mandabuddhi. And Mandabuddhi simply means that they are not able to think in terms of the highest, sharpest way in which we need to think. What does that mean? So if you say that, if you say that an object exists or an object is there but you cannot know it, but it is also something that you cannot say that you don't know it, then one way to think about such an object is to say that it doesn't exist. Because if you say there is something that you can, you don't know it, you cannot know it, then we can think of something and say, oh, there must be something that maybe perhaps my eyes, my ears, etc., all the senses are not capable of recognizing its entity because I am not given these powers. But then if you go on and say, but that the object is also something that you cannot say, you don't know it, then you question the very existence of the object. I can imagine that there is something I don't know. But then you cannot imagine something that you don't know but you know also, isn't it? So it's difficult. So therefore, a Mandabuddhi, a person with limited intellectual capacity, sharp capacity, may come to the conclusion that therefore there is no such thing as Brahman. So we will go into nihilism. And there is no such entity called God, there is no such entity which is supreme consciousness. There is nothing but a big, large void. So therefore that also has to be negated by the teacher. Therefore he creates this effulgent entity in this story, hovering in front of the devatas. And he calls it a yaksha. Now the question arises, why a yaksha? Because we know there are Gandharva, Kinnar and all those are there. Why did Brahman appear as a yaksha? So we find that in Vedas, yaksha is equated as Brahman. Brahman does not have any, Brahman is not sakar, it is nirakar. But then when a sakar swarupa is to be presented, it is presented as yaksha. So there is a reference to Brahma Maha, yaksha as a Brahma Maha. That's a, in Mahabharata also actually there is a reference I have read, Brahma Maha. So therefore this yaksha is nothing other than a sakar swarup. Sakar means a, you understand, right? It's a, with a form. So formless is given a form. Also yaksha is, the literal meaning of yaksha is that which is very effulgent. Now, Brahman has always been mentioned as Swaprakasam. Swaprakas is Swayam Prakasam. That means you don't need a flashlight or another artificial light or even the sun for that matter to see the Brahman. Brahman always is present at all times. The deeper meaning of that is that I am always present, I know that. Nobody needs to tell me that, hey, you are there. Isn't it? Supposing my eyesight is weak and I said, where is the Sauchi? Then somebody says, hey, he is sitting in the front or what you mean? Because it is somebody other than me. But will I ever ask you where I am? No. It is self-effulgent. So this life principle, this Brahmanhood of mine tells me exactly that I am right here at all times. That is the deeper meaning. But we can say it is Swayam Prakasam, it is effulgent. So this is shown as an effulgent globe or a sphere that appears in the middle of that battlefield suspended in air. So that is also yaksha. Okay. Then in the story it is said that one after the other devatas actually approach and then they did not get any knowledge and all that. So it is indicating how difficult it is to get Brahma Vidya. Now this is the theme of many of these texts as to how difficult it is. And in all these texts the idea is not to show you, therefore don't try it. You know, it is like if you see the movie that The Conquest of Everest, and there is an ice slide or what, a snow slide or whatever, and then people die, this, that. Then looking at that, even if I had a remote idea that someday I will go, yes, I am not going there, isn't it? Why Everest? We don't even go to Kailas, isn't it? That is not the idea though here. The idea is that it is so rare that a rare individual like you must get it. In fact, in the Vivek Chudamani, the whole Vivek Chudamani starts pretty much after the adoration of the Guru. Jantunam Narajanma Durlabham Ataha. Among all the millions and millions of different species that you could have become, Narajanma Durlabham. Being born as a human is indeed a rarity. And then pustvam tato viprata, and then to have this courage that I will attain that which is my janma siddhak. Tilakji at Swaraj is my janma siddhak. This is actually my right is to know who I am. So that courage we must have. Viprata. And then luckily we are actually born with all the good qualities. The very fact that we have given up the bed and early in the morning and are here is a good indication that I have some sattvic qualities. And then Vedika Dharma Marga Parata, that also we are happy to be born in India where we know what is Vedic Marga, what is the Vedic path of living life. So nicely pointed out. Perhaps more elaborately than many other cultures and civilizations. So at least whether we follow it or not is a different thing, but at least it's available to us. Vedic Dharma Marga Parata. So therefore we follow that. And then Atma Anatma Vivechana. I'm able to actually discriminate between what is permanent, what is impermanent, and come to recognize Brahman And then it says, Brahman samsthitihi. Then I abide in that knowledge at all times. Satajanma koti punya vinana labhyate. Such a great opportunity will not be available if we had not toiled for sat koti, but crores and crores of, tens and hundreds of millions of life cycles we must have gone through to come to this point. Therefore, the idea is, please do not waste this life. So that idea is given here. Therefore, the teacher is very careful. He doesn't distinguish between who is intelligent student and who is Uttam and who is Madhyam and who is Mandadhikari. He wants everybody to follow the path. He understands. The teacher understands that for some it may take little longer, but that everybody is capable of and everyone must try to achieve that. And therefore, the story is put into this Upanishad. Usually Upanishads don't have stories. Although we will see that in Kathopanishad also, Kathopanishad in fact starts with a story. The next Upanishad in the scheme of study will be Kathopanishad. It starts with a story. But indeed, stories are rare, because Upanishads are supposed to give the direct knowledge. Okay. Then, the idea is that after this, contemplation is to be done. So therefore, through the story, the teacher is trying to prepare the mind for contemplation. This is a very important point, because contemplation cannot be on that which is without a form. Contemplation means what? Mananam. Mananam means what? Again and again I am refreshing in my mind. So that requires some avalamban, that requires some support. So therefore the story will then become a support. And then the most important is, through this story it is shown that any kind of an ego, that I was able to do this or I am capable of doing it, is indeed the biggest challenge and obstacle in the path of spirituality. Therefore, kartrutva, bhoktrutva and abhiman, these three are to be given up. The sense of doership, the sense of enjoyership and the sense of pride or ego is to be given up. So that is the main theme of this story. So in the 16th chapter also, in the very first, in all the values, 26 values, the very first value is what? Amanitvam. And there are so many stories in our Purana that talks about how that Damba needs to be annihilated. Even people like Hanumanji, the name itself means one who has actually vanquished ego. Even you will find that there is a story about him where he also got infatuated with. Why? Why is it those coming? Because again and again those stories try to indicate to us that path of spirituality, giving up the ego, is the first and the last step of salvation. So we must start with annihilating the ego, and then when it is completely gone, that is when we will actually have the Brahma Jnana. So that is also an important point in this story. Okay, now let us understand the story. Then if it is necessary, I think we'll go through the mantra, but I don't think that is really needed. So the story is that the Sura and Asura, the Devata and the Rakshasa, the godly things, godly beings or gods, and the devil are continuously fighting with one another. This is in every religion, this is there. So our religion also has these stories. They are continuously fighting. Why are they fighting? Because They don't want to see each other happy. That there is no other reason to fight. They cannot coexist. So everybody, each one of them is trying to vanquish the other and rule over them. They cannot coexist. So today also all the violence in the world is only because of that. Because there is enough space on earth for everybody to remain happy. But we fight. And people get attached. In ashram also they get attached to the particular chair. If we go to yoga classes, then we are attached to a particular spot, you know. I came 10 minutes early, but that lady took my spot. That the whole class, we are thinking that only. There's enough room for everybody to sit. No. So that is all devilish tendencies in us. So instead of enjoying the class, we are worried the whole time. 1 minute early, that guy came and he took my seat. So anyway, because they are fighting all the time, when there was one time when they fought. And of course the devas have the sattvic tendency. So therefore satyameva jayate, those who have sattvic tendencies, in the eventuality they will win. The meek shall inherit the earth. Bible also says, right? So people who are simple-minded, people who have sattvic qualities, who are peaceful in nature, but compassionate in nature, caring in nature, not bent upon destroying the other, eventually they will win. So therefore, in this war also between the devil and the God, I will call it Sura and Asura because every time. So Devata and Danava, let's say. So between Devata and Danava, this Devatas win, the gods win. And of course, when somebody wins, whether it is election party or whatnot, a lot of Madeira flows, a lot of beer and wine and hoo-hoo, you know. So they were just petting each other and say, oh, this was such a great victory. Agni, you did so well. And Agni will say, no, no, why? It is because of you that God of fire, God of wind. And then Indra, of course, everybody praises Indra because he is the Lord of the Lord. So in such talks, they all became infatuated with the idea that it is because of us that we won the war. With my power, with my ability, I achieved this. You know, we also many times come under such ideas. So it is very important to remind that all the time that if I am able to give a good lecture, it is because of His grace. If the lecture didn't come out good, then it is because of His grace. But then we must add one more sentence. I must try to do better tomorrow. You cannot say it's His grace, so therefore, okay, it is also acceptable. So then ego will not rise. Otherwise somebody says, oh, today I enjoyed it so much, immediately the mercury will rise. Yeah, I know. I'm glad you told me. Such vanity is so easy to come, isn't it? So therefore it came to these devas also. Now, if such vanity were to come to the asura, the Danava, then the supreme consciousness would not have worried too much. Because the path for their path is much more. You know, they are all involved in more rajas and more tamas. So therefore the tamas has to go into rajas, rajas then will evolve into sattva and all that. But these sattvic people, a good person who is given to good deeds and that sort of thing. So the Supreme Consciousness thought that this is not really good. that I must interject at this time and try to remove their pride, which is ill-based. Therefore, all of a sudden, when they were petting each other and they were actually lifting the beer mug and drinking, one of the devatas observed that there is some effulgent light suspended in air. And that particular devata was not enough drunk to say, oh, this is just an illusion. So therefore he said, hey, look at that. So all of a sudden all the devatas started looking at it. They could not determine what it is. And it is said that that light did not come to them too close. It was a little bit further away. And that is to say that when something is a little further away, you cannot comprehend. So a little further away, you can say, oh, I don't know who is that coming. Maybe it is this person, that person. You don't know. So therefore, they all got confused as to what that is. And it remained there also. It wasn't coming closer. So therefore, they say, Agni Devata, why don't you go and see who that is? So, God of Fire. Now the question may arise, why God of Fire first? You know, because according to the Paramparagat, from Akash, Vayu has come, from Vayu, Agni has come. So Vayu is actually elder to Agni. So for such cases, you know, elderly person should go. Why Agni? Why fire? So again, some commentators have given a lot of nice ideas. Why fire? Because fire is actually the FedEx service. So when you do yajna, yagadi, om, ityadi, there is a fire is burned. And there, whether we are pouring oblations to Vayu or anything else, we pour into what? Fire. And then it is assumed that that fire will, that, what is it called? That the fire will actually carry that essence to the heavens and to the particular devata, wherever the address is given, the FedEx will deliver there. So we don't say that, okay, now I am offering it to the devata of water, so bring me some water. No, no, always we pour it into fire. So fire is the messenger service. So therefore the messenger service actually goes first to find out and bring the message, isn't it? Who is this? So therefore Agni Devata went there. Now Agni Devata actually went there with the idea that, oh, of course, I'll find out who it is. I'll come back and let you know, with a very big ego. Fire God approached this entity. But before he could ask that entity who you are, that entity said, hey, who are you? You know, it is like if the Swamiji is here, you know, in ochre robe and everything. And somebody comes for the lecture, and the Swamiji is standing right there. And then that person will say, hey, I never seen you here before, who are you? Swamiji will be get the shock of his life. What do you mean, who are you? Don't you see the my picture on the posters? Isn't it? So like that, this Agni Deva, he thought everybody knows who I am. My very form is of that of fire. I mean, you can see I am nothing but fire. What do you mean, who are you? So his ego got very much hurt at that time. And so with a lot of pride, he said, what do you mean, who are you? I am the God of fire. He said, what can you do? This is even as, what do you mean you can do? So he asked Swamiji, so, oh, you are Swamiji, why are you here? What do you mean? I'm the one who is going to give lecture, isn't it? So like that, this entity asked that Agni Dev, so what do you do? He said, what do you mean, what do you do? I can burn up each and everything in this entire universe. I have so much power, I can burn up anything. That's what I do, you understand? So that entity said, okay. But she said, no, you don't have to burn anything. Let me just give you this blade of grass. Just burn that much. So I know that, okay, you're really powerful. You know, this blade of grass, if you can burn, then I know your power. So just the blade of grass is given. Now the question may arise, why blade of grass? So the blade of grass actually indicates that essence of life in the most lowest form. So if there was some big thing was to be burnt up, some huge entity is to be burnt up, then there is lot of life in it. Like you say, okay, burn this elephant. Elephant. But this little blade of grass, not much life is there. You know? It's barely surviving like that. But the idea is it is the same supreme consciousness that is in the blade of grass. It's also in the whale, also in the elephant, also in the humans. The same supreme. So that supreme consciousness has the same strength. So therefore this Agni Devata just looked at it and said, come on, you could have given me something bigger. He doesn't say that, but he thinks like that. And then he just does, the blade of grass doesn't get burned. So then he gets more power, and he gives it more power, then he really blows with fire, you know, he blows fire onto it with more power. Nothing happens to the blade of grass. Then he understood that there's some garbage. So just as when Virat Kohli walks into the ground with lot of pride that the whole victory of the team is dependent on me. And when he gets out on the third ball, you see how he walks back. Natmastaka. Like that, Agni Devata came back. He had gone there with a lot of pride that I am the one who is, I'm the best person among the devatas to find out what this entity is. But when he could not do anything to that little blade of grass, he came back to the devatas. Now they thought that, oh, Agni could not find out. So he goes back and says, I am sorry, I could not find out. That's all he says. I could not find out who he is. So now the devatas confer again and then say, that Vayu, you go. Because Vayu is, you know, elder to Agni. So Vayu goes and approaches this entity. Same dialogue happens. Before the Vayu can say anything, this entity asks, who are you? He said, you don't know, I am Vayu. I can blow up everything. I can blow away everything. You don't know my force. You don't know my power. So that blade of grass was still there. So he said, no, don't do all that. Just this blade of grass, just blow that away so I know your power. And Vayudevata also could not do anything to that blade of grass. Try as he might, nothing happened. That blade of grass remained there. So he also came back as Suresh Raina. Anyway, it's another cricketer. You understand? So he came back and he said, I'm sorry, I could not find out who that entity is. Now it is becoming very clear that whatever this entity is, these devatas were incapable of finding out. Therefore, they decided that now the Lord of the Lord, Indra, must approach them. So Indra, of course, because he is the king of all gods, he has even bigger ego, isn't it? I am the supreme god, of course I will go and find out. So with that attitude, Indra taking big strides, approached this entity, but as he approached the entity disappeared. So that is the biggest insult, because with other at least the entity talked. With Indra he said, forget it, you are not even worth a minute of my time. The entity disappeared. Now Indra, Agni and Vayu, so we have to know. So these sense organs are also called devas. Not sense organs, but the senses are called devas. So therefore, the idea is that the senses will not be able to perceive it. Senses will not be able to find out who it is. So it's the same story. Story is actually repeating what is in the first and second part of Nisan. Na chaksur gachati, etc. The eyes cannot go there, the ears cannot go there, etc., etc. Now Indra represents mind, because all the five sense indriyas cannot function unless mind is there. So eyes may be working, ears may be working, all this may be working. But unless the mind is there to identify what I am seeing, who you, etc., etc., eyes are useless by themselves. So therefore mind is like the controller. That is the picture in this Krishna also, when he's holding the rein, five reins in his hands. The five horses are what? They are all five senses. So therefore that Indra is therefore the king, the lord of the lord, the devas, king of all the devas. So that is the mind. Now the another point is that mind is actually the subtler entity, not a gross entity. So when the mind appears, mind approaches this entity which is in a form, the form has to disappear. But mind being very subtle, thinks about it and say, wait a minute, how did this form disappear? So therefore the question arises that maybe this is something that is beyond my mind. This is something that is beyond my comprehension. And the moment that question arises in Indra's mind, a beautiful woman form appears, which is described here as Uma Hemavati. Why woman? So far only man, people going there also man, and that entity appearing also, it is not said it is a man, because you cannot give any manliness to Brahman or womanliness for that matter. Why all of a sudden now the woman comes? So there are a number of reasons are there. Women are more compassionate than men. And therefore this Indra is worthy of compassion. So therefore a woman form gives him the upadesh. It tells him who that entity was. A compassion. So any guru is compassionate. The woman is not to be taken literally, or man is not to be taken literally. Otherwise the whole confusion will come in our sastra. So we all have both qualities. So here the compassion quality is required, because Indra is standing there and he is flabbergasted. He comes to understand, okay, this is something that is beyond my apprehension and comprehension. Therefore, he is flabbergasted. So therefore, he needs a teacher who can tell him what that tattva was, what was that effulgent mass that appeared here just a while ago. Therefore, a woman form is there. Another thing is Uma Hemavati. Now Hemavati can be taken many ways. So therefore that woman was adorned with golden ornaments. So that golden ornaments was giving lot of effulgent light. Or you can say Hemavati. So Uma is who? Parvati. Parvati is daughter of mountain. So therefore daughter of the mountain, Umaji is there. So Parvati has come. And number of meanings can be taken. Anyway, the Vedic literature says Uma is what? So Uma, there is a Uma is Om. So it is said that all the Vedic knowledge, the sense, the essence of the Vedic knowledge is in the Upanishads. And the essence of all the Upanishadic knowledge is in Om. So Om is the most concentrated form of knowledge. Entire Vedas is actually in Om. So therefore if you repeat Om, 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 that means you are studying all the Vedas. The punya that we accrue is equal to reading all the Vedas. So Om is the most concentrated. Therefore, that is the knowledge. So Om is the knowledge. And it is said that in Om, Auma, the A stands for Brahman. The Brahman, which is an unmanifest entity. And Uma stands for Prakriti. So Uma is the Prakriti. So now this is the first reflection of that Brahman. It is the manifested form of Brahman. Therefore, Uma represents nothing other than the manifested form of. So, Guru is nothing other than the manifested form of Brahman. So, therefore, this Guru has appeared in the form of, in the form that can communicate with us, because Brahman cannot communicate. So now the communication is possible between Indra and Uma. So in the fourth chapter, for first mantra, this continues. So Uma says, you don't know. That alone was the Brahman. So he says that was the Brahman. That effulgent mass that you saw is none other than what is described as Brahman, Brahman, Brahman in Veda Shastra. That is Brahman. And then 9 more mantras are there in the fourth chapter where Upadesh is given and Upasana is given. What practice one must pursue. And finally, out of the compassion, the teacher also says that in order for anyone to get to this point, the truth will reveal itself if certain qualifications are met. So those certain qualifications, we will see them, are also enumerated in this fourth chapter. Okay.
Silly question. Why is it named Brahman and not anything else?
Well, so Brahman means, it comes from the word Bru. Right? And so Bru means that which is so big that it is so expansive that it covers everything. So with that, I think that Brahman came. The root Bru means all expansive.
Another question. We're supposed to meditate and experience or real, whatever you want to say, experience or realize or understand that you are that. And you interact in the world, you could also see as a you're interacting with the form, Brahman with form.
Yes.
And look at everybody as a Brahman and just see that they are acting that way because of their prakriti modification,
yes,
or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be the final thing to achieve?
So you were there yesterday? No.
Yeah,
you were there?
Yesterday.
Okay. So basically, yeah. So meditation is not a necessary.
People sit all the time in meditation thinking, oh, I'm Brahman anyway.
No, the madness. So the most important sadhana in spirituality is to become Brahmanista. Brahmanista means we abide in that knowledge at all times.
Yeah, so everything and every person, everything you see is part of that. Whether, you know, then we talk about non-violence and violence. So, you know, but then I think we need to eliminate the prakriti which is hurting the majority of the people there. Where there the non-violence doesn't really work. And we need to, I mean,
so, yeah, it is a complicated thing.
Yeah.
Right. It's a complicated thing. So, the number one is, okay, so meditation is not a necessary ingredient for Brahma Vidya. Second is, meditation is only a form of upasana. It is no different than any other upasana. And the third thing is, when we become Brahmanista, then we will actually, our whole transformation would have been so complete that we see nothing other than Brahman in everything and everyone that we interact with.
That is right.
So, but in spite of all that, so like Gandhiji said, you know, he has no problem with the Britishers. It is the
rule.
Yeah. So even if you can, that is how Arjuna actually fought in the war. As a person, he could not do anything. I mean, as a person, he said, no, I cannot. How do you expect me to?
Relationship.
Yeah, with relationship. How do you expect me to even fight Bhishma Pitama? But then when he came to understand that what Bhishma Pitama stands for at this time in the war is something different than what Bhishma Pitama is. Therefore,
so in other words, you are really killing the prakriti of the
correct
form, and not necessarily Brahman cannot die. Anyway.
Right.
So,
so the correct. So all the turbulence that was being created had to come to an end. But then Mahabharata also shows that whatever the action is, even if it's a good action, it does have repercussions. So, yeah. In fact, you can see it here playing out today in the Iraq war and Afghan war, I mean, and even, yeah. So everything will have repercussion. Ek aur ultrasound kar lete. Because I think this time she is really hoping that everything has gone. Because, if you don't mind. Because.
I was thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. What is it that then, if something is there still, suppose it has not gone down or anything like that, then I think we'll have to think about what is the next step. So the whole point is that if it is gone down or it's not, okay, bleeding to band ho gaya. This has not happened in the last three months. So last time karate uske baad kuch hua nahi. And she is doing this Ayurvedic treatment as well as this naturopathy treatment. So both of them are saying it should not be there, or it should have at least reduced. So ek bar kara le, because it is non-invasive, you know. Phir to nahi hai, to phir to kuch karana hi padega. That's what the idea is.
So
phir to kuch karenge, ya to cats can't get.
Bleeding
nahi. This is gone away. So maybe that's a good sign.
Right.
So she is really hoping that that's what it is.
Nityasnam is like abiding in that knowledge at all times. But then when you do that, it is again being aware.
So Nididhyasana is, so knowledge now you have, right? I mean, okay, so there is not, the knowledge is very simple in the sense, okay. What we are experiencing is nothing but Brahman.
but when you're aware of it.
So but have we benefited from that? So the idea is no, benefits have not come yet. So therefore the whole life becomes nothing other than upasana only. So upasana means whether you worship or whether we do meditation or whatever other form of upasana we do, that we should continue. That is slowly what will happen is the mind begins to abide in that truth at all the times. Right? So as time goes on, more and more, so eventually time will come when you are abiding in that at all times. So you don't lose focus, no matter what happens. Whether there is a calamitous situation, or whether there is a joyous situation, or whether something happens suddenly, or whatever. And so a lot of stories are there to indicate that. So actually it is said that when Vivekananda was sitting there in meditation, somebody actually fired a gun just to show whether he is really in meditation. He didn't flinch. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. So the idea is that even if there is something sudden that happens, you are not moved. Even momentarily you are not moved because you are abiding in that knowledge at all times.
But then when you are abiding in that knowledge at all times, at least when you are trying to, but even then it's still being aware of something, so it's still not knowing the Brahman. Or like yesterday when you were saying, we know it but we still don't know it because it's so subtle.
So when we said we don't know it or we can't know it, it is only from the point of view of knowledge as other knowledges. So we will not be able to categorically know Brahman
as
an entity.
Because anything that is knowing is becomes an object.
Correct.
So it's never the subject.
So it is never the subject. So this thing is beyond object and subject both. So it's neither a subject nor it's the very essence because of which the subject is a subject. So you will never come to know it. So therefore all experiences, if say, oh, I had experience of Brahman, this is stupid. You cannot have experience of Brahman because all experiences were because of the Brahman, not the other way around. So you are behind the torchlight, now you cannot put it in front of the torchlight. Right? Reflect on it, yeah.
Okay. So when the torch light is the Brahman and we are always behind
Torchlight is the Brahman, then the battery is the Brahman, right?
Battery is the Brahman.
So the flashlight is not the Brahman, but the battery which is powering the torch is the Brahman.
So that we can never know.
That
we can
only
know the objects which the light
correct.
Is.
But all we can understand is that, oh, it is in the power of that battery that I am able to see everything.